From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 83 of Little Brother for the 30th of April, 2022. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. I think that's a record. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me, Critter, at littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. Earlier this week, the European Union passed a law that had been proposed in the late 2020. The new law, called the Digital Services Act, will require digital services to provide mechanisms for accountability and transparency to include ways to seek redress for moderation, transparency in how data is handled, protection for minors, safeguards for public health, prevention of misuse, and a whole bunch of other interesting things. Of greatest interest, though, is the data handling transparency. Apparently, under this new law, the EU can require that large digital services, such as Google, Meta, and others, provide some explanation of how their algorithms work. Well, there's an interesting fly in the ointment, though. Apparently, according to an unrelated leaked memo, Meta actually does not know how their algorithm works. It's based on machine learning. And as sometimes happens with such systems, it's figured out its own way and doesn't really offer much in the way of insight as to how it draws its conclusions. I think I'm going to need some popcorn for this one. Speaking of digital services in the European Union, the dialog boxes produced by Google asking for permission to use cookies have been found not to meet the requirements of the General Data Protection Regulation, familiar to many as the GDPR, and France's primary watchdog, the Commission Nationale de l'Informatique et de Liberté, CNIL for short, fined Google 150 million euro, as I described in episode 67. In order to become compliant, Google have now implemented a reject all cookies button that European users can click to reject the cookies. Go figure. A Redditor believed to be a nurse at the Mission Trail Baptist Hospital in San Antonio, Texas, has posted about an absolutely alarming practice that the hospital has recently announced. In an apparent attempt to save money, the hospital has closed its IT department, withdrawn all hospital-issued laptop computers, and told nurses to bring their own laptops from home to use at work. There are so many things wrong with this, but for starters, there is the obvious question of whether or not the systems are secure. Without an IT department to ensure that they are, I would expect that hospital to leak HIPAA-protected data like a sieve. On top of that, some nurses may not own a laptop, some may have some that are inadequate to meet the need, and others may have some that are high-end and too expensive and precious to be subjecting them to a healthcare environment. Any way you slice it, this is bad policy, and I'll be keeping an eye out for them to land in the Pwn of the Week. The police in Chula Vista, California, are celebrating their 10,000th drone call. It has only taken them 3 years to get to this point, which, if you slap some math on it, will tell you that they have averaged about 274 drone deployments per day. The department has claimed that the drones were only to be deployed in emergencies. However, this large number of deployments per day suggests instead that they are being used for other purposes, suggesting perhaps that the town is being a bit over-surveilled. The city's history with ALPR technology would seem to back this conclusion. I would be remiss if I did not mention the $44 billion elephant in the room. That is the amount of money that Elon Musk has put on the table to purchase Twitter, with stated intentions to take the company private and loosen the rules. There's a lot of speculation about how this will shape up, but only Musk knows for sure what he's up to. He has referred to himself as a free speech absolutist. In anticipation, however, the European Union have already advised Musk that there are rules, and if they are not followed, that fines up to 6% of the company's revenue can be levied, and that they can, if needed, be banned from operating in Europe. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned This Week. The Pwn of the Week is... Wait, am I looking at the right script here? Oh, yeah. Yes, I am. All right, this is kind of funny, actually. Let me rewind the tape and play you something from episode 48 back in August. On Monday, T-Mobile confirmed that they were hacked. Not a ransomware attack this time, but instead customer data were stolen, including social security numbers, IMEIs, names, addresses, phone numbers, for roughly 30 million customers. Right. Okay. Now, here's from episode 66 at the start of the year. Finally, surprising nobody, T-Mobile has been pwned. Again. Okay. Now, with that out of the way, I had to go and make this wisecrack last week. Some companies don't even seem to act like it's any kind of a big deal to get pwned. T-Mobile! Excuse me, my allergies are horrible this time of year. And so, this week we welcome back our returning champions, T-Mobile! This pwn was brought to us by our other returning champion, Lapsus, who managed to make off with the source code for some of T-Mobile's internal company tools. While they were there, they also were poking around and gathering information on T-Mobile accounts associated with the FBI and the Department of Defense. The breach was made by way of social engineering T-Mobile employees and getting credentials to get onto the company's VPN. Having gained access, they were also able to make hassle-free SIM swaps. As promised last week, I'm going to take a few minutes of this episode to talk about a router firmware called DDWRT. DDWRT is the classic. This is the Slackware Linux of router firmwares. It's been around for just a little under two decades and was originally developed for the Linksys WRT54G router, the classic little blue box with two antennas on the back. That was one of the most common Wi-Fi routers at the time. BrainSlayer, the developer behind DDWRT, made the observation that this particular router was running on hardware that could run Linux, and so he constructed a build for it, and DDWRT was born. So, what can it do? Well, first and foremost, and probably most important, as I mentioned last week, DDWRT is still maintained, which may not be the case for the native firmware for older routers. Second, in addition to working as a router, it can also work as a client or a client bridge, allowing wired Ethernet devices to access a wireless network or as a repeater, aka a range extender. Third, it gives you access to a number of enterprise-grade or power user features, such as using certificates for access, working with a Radius server, functioning as a public hotspot with a captive portal, that sort of thing. In short, it becomes a full-featured Swiss Army knife of a device, and to put this into perspective for you, I can get these enterprise-grade features on a 15-year-old router that cost me $40 brand new 15 years ago. Of course, it can run on contemporary and high-end kit as well. So, let's talk about how you get it. As I mentioned last week, before you begin, you'll want to make sure that your router is capable of running this firmware. Locate the label on the bottom or back of your router and get the exact model and version of your router hardware. Then go hit DDWRT's website, that's dd-wrt.com, and click the link that says Router Database. Enter part or all of your router's model number in there, and you'll get a list of builds that are available for it. I have here an ancient Linksys E1000, that's that 15-year-old router I was talking about a moment ago. It's a Class N. It's well supported by DDWRT. So on that page, I just enter E1000, and it comes up with two results, one for the hardware version 1.0, and one for versions 2.0 and 2.1. All right, my spare router here is a 2.1, and clicking there brings me to a page with firmware to download. Now, once you've found the right build, you just download it to your PC and just leave it in the downloads folder for right now. Now, you'll want to do just a couple more things before committing to the change. First, you'll probably want to have an Ethernet cable ready to plug your computer into your router. Now, you can do this one over the Wi-Fi if you really, really, really want to, but using a wired connection is potentially more reliable. The other thing is that you will want to make a note of any important configurations you have put into your router because you're going to lose them, and you may want to refer to them when you're getting things set back up. All right, so it's go time. You should set aside about an hour undisturbed to do this. I can usually do it in about 15 minutes, but I like to set aside an hour just in case things go wrong. Disconnect your internet from your router, connect the router to your computer, locate the page in the router configuration for firmware upgrades, and then you go and you upload that file that you saved in your downloads folder from DDWRT's website. Now, it may take a few minutes for the router to install the new firmware, and then it'll reboot. While it's rebooting, you might notice the network connection to your computer go down and up a few times, but eventually everything will stabilize, and when the lights on the router have settled into a stable pattern, unplug and replug the Ethernet cable from your computer. This will basically just get your computer to reset its network connection and pull a new IP address from the router. For most routers, the router will have given itself the IP address of 192.168.1.1. Go ahead and enter that into your web browser, and you should be presented with a page asking you to set up your username and the password for the router. This is actually the only wizard you will encounter in this firmware. Don't ask me why they hide the username. I have no idea. Once you click the Change Password button at the bottom, it'll take you to the dashboard page. Now, the most important thing to do now is to set up your wireless. By default, the SSID is DD-WRT, and it has no Wi-Fi password. And you're going to want to fix that before anything else. Go to the Wireless tab, Basic Settings sub-tab, and look for the field that says Wireless Network Name. Fill that in with whatever name you want your network to have, and you may also want to set the wireless channel to auto while you're on this page. Now bounce over to the Wireless Security sub-tab, set the security mode to WPA2-PSK, unless you specifically know that you need it to be something else. A few new fields will appear, one of which is for the WPA shared key, and this is where you'll want to put what you want for a wireless password. Now go to the bottom of the page and click Apply Settings. Once that's set and returned, you can plug the internet back in, move off to the wireless if you want, and then explore the rest of the settings at your leisure. I would encourage you to just kind of poke around and learn things. If you've got a spare router that you can put this on, it might be best to do that and then use that as a practice piece before moving on to doing this with your main router. I want to get a little more technical with this week's OPSEC tip. I want to talk to you about your passwords. Let's be clear about a thing. We all hate passwords. It really is just that simple. Passwords suck. Password policies suck more. Unfortunately, the only thing standing between the marauding hordes of the internet and your stuff is this flimsy combination lock. So how do we make it less flimsy? The answer is two-factor authentication. Two-factor authentication means you have a system in place where you have to provide not just a password, but also something else. Your ATM card is a perfectly good example of this. To get cash out of an ATM, you need not just the card, but also a PIN. Or not just a PIN, but also a card. While we may disagree with them, the banks have calculated that this mitigates the risk enough not to spend the money to improve upon it, and truth be told, it's actually not horrible. So, what is a factor? Authentication factors generally fall into three categories. One, something that you know, such as a password or a PIN. Two, something that you have, such as your ATM card or a key fob or something installed on a digital device. And three, something that you are, such as your fingerprint, your voice print, or a retina scan. Now, installations like what was depicted in the Hollywood film Sneakers, where a voice print is used, are actually pretty rare due to the logistics involved in setting them up. We're still a long way off from me having to say, "Hi, my name is Chuck Ritter. My voice is my passport. Verify me," to get into my computer or past a locked door. Indeed, for most of us in our daily lives, we're going to see something like a code or a notification sent to a phone or a one-time password of some sort. The simplest thing to implement here is a code sent to a phone. When you go to log in, they look up your phone number, which you were required to provide at some point, and send a text message to the phone with a code, usually a 6-digit number, that you then enter into the service you're logging into. Some SMS apps, Signal for instance, will even do you the favor of putting a button there when a code is detected, allowing you to quickly copy the code so you can paste it into whatever app you're logging into, in case that might help. TOTP, or time-based one-time passwords, are another technique, and the one I personally prefer. A digital device that might be simple enough to fit into a key fob, but could also be an app on a phone or a computer, takes a secret value that you've put into it, throws it into a mathematical function with the current time of day, and out comes a number, usually 6 digits, that is valid for 30 to 60 seconds, depending on the system. The math on it is well-defined and standardized in RFC 6238, so it's, yeah, a standard. There are dozens of different applications that implement it, and you can use any of them, and they will all produce the same code at the same time. I know. I've tried it. My personal favorites are Google Authenticator, KeePass XC, and Authenticator for Chrome, which I have confirmed also works in Brave and Chromium. KeePass XC is open source, so it has that going for it, and there are at least 20 open source Android apps, but I'm going to admit I haven't tried most of them yet. Phone pings are kind of a cross between the two. Google services use these pretty effectively with Android users. If you log in, say, to YouTube or Gmail from someplace they weren't expecting, they'll send a notification to your phone to ask you to verify that it was you. Other apps that achieve the same effect exist also. Microsoft Authenticator, for instance, can do both pings and TOTP. Then there are also some more advanced techniques, such as cryptographic certificates, USB keys, smart cards, and others, which I'm not going to get into right now because they're a more advanced topic and maybe better covered at a later date in more depth. I'm not a fan of phone pings for a couple of reasons. First, they require you to install a specific app on your phone, and if your phone gets lost or rendered unusable for some reason, you are stuck. Oh, that includes, by the way, no service. If you're out in the boonies or deep inside an industrial building with no service and no Wi-Fi, the game is over and you lost. You can't get in, and there's no inherent way to get around it without persuading somebody to let you in. I'm also not a fan of sending codes via text messages because they not only suffer from the same problems as phone pings, but there's also one other very large risk. I mentioned it when I was talking about the Pwn of the Week this week. What was it? SIM swaps. If your cellular provider gets pwned, not that that would ever happen, or if they can be persuaded by some silver-tongued rogue that they are you, then your codes can get redirected to a device of their choice rather than a device of yours. On top of that, text messages are not always timely. TOTP, on the other hand, can exist in more than one place. You can have it on your phone, plus a burner device, plus a laptop, a desktop, you know, wherever you need it. Transferring it from one device to another is as simple as scanning a QR code, but the best part is that it works offline. You can use it to log into things that don't have a working network connection, either for security purposes or because they're broken, or an outside network connection, same thing, and you don't need a network connection to make it work. As long as there's an agreement on the secret and the time of day, it works. Just, you know, obviously if you put it on multiple devices, make sure you secure them all appropriately. So, the tip of the week is this. Wherever you can, use two-factor authentication. It will strengthen your logins beyond what your password can do. Of the three I talked about this week, TOTP is the best, then phone pings, then text messages. Several social media networks implement it, including both Reddit and Facebook. So do GitHub and Amazon. Bank websites probably should, but they don't usually. Though I have noticed that Chase is an exception to this, and Discover will text you a code if they don't recognize your web browser. Anyway, next week, I will talk a little bit about how to better manage your passwords, making them both more secure and easier to use all at once. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fungaboo and The Crowded Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to David, Azriel, Joe Cadillac, and Lotus for story leads. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Punt music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker. And our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well. This is episode 83 of Little Brother for the 29th of April, 2022. 30th of April, fuck me raw. Stay tuned, Little Brother, I'm gonna start that full fucking thing over. And a whole bunch of other interesting things. Okay, let's try that again. And did I say Linux or Linux another? You know what, let's start it over. It's well supported by or a notification sent to a phone or a one-time passport. Bah! Record skipped. My personal favorites are Google Authenticator, KeePass XC, and the Cat Meowed.